Today's program was brought to you by the Christmas Tree Farmers Association of New York, partnering with Grow NYC on a pilot project to make farm fresh trees and wreaths available at green markets. For more information, visit ChristmasTreesNY.org.
This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
We talk about food, we talk about music, with musical dudes, finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Ready for love.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Greg Bresnitz. That was just the present, who will be live later on today. Happy Thanksgiving weekend to all. I hope everyone is traveling safely today. On the show today, we'd like to welcome Roberto Diaco from East 12th Australia. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
It's kind of hard to figure out where to start because your career and education has been, it seems like it's more than one person when reading about your background. But what grabs me was that you were in the Air Force and you jumped out of airplanes.
Sure, I did.
And I'm curious if anything during that year of training prepared you for a life in the kitchen.
Well, it was part of, that is part of growing up in Italy. It was a mandatory job, and basically it actually had nothing to do with then cooking in the kitchen. I used to cook much earlier, since I was 12. So,
is there any place along your education that really sticks out, or any lessons that you took early on that shaped the way that you cook today?
Sure. In the north of Italy, where I'm from, techniques are mostly French. So you can imagine, Italian products, French-oriented techniques, is probably the best choice. Even more, most of the restaurants in northern Italy have kind of a French influence in techniques only.
Is there any marriage of the two styles, or what is there one way of doing anything that you prefer, an Italian way over a French way?
Let's say we respect more the products. That's for certain. We have more simplicity going on in our recipes. Still with some decent techniques, I do think that we can get out kind of a better result in flavors. We don't have to hide any kind of original flavors from the products.
No hiding. No secret sauces. No.
That's also my way to cook. You taste what you see in the dish.
If I were to ask you to pick four ingredients for me to cook a dish, what would the four ingredients be?
I'm kind of a mushroom fanatic.
Okay.
I really love porcini. I'm coming from an area where we have probably one of the best porcini in the Alps. It's the south part of the Alps. And porcini plays a big role where I'm from, including some truffles and chanterelles, which are fiendly. It's definitely porcini paired with any kind of pasta, or let's make it more luxurious with some langoustines paired. Mediterranean crustaceans with porcini and truffle is just fantastic.
So we're going to pause the show right now. We're going to go to your kitchen. You're going to make this for me. We're going to come back.
Let's do it.
What is it about the porcini that grabs you? I know you grew up with it and it's familiar, but what is it about that particular mushroom that holds such a special place?
It's already the way it grows. It grows when the moon turns, and it must rain. So basically they pop up in one night.
Oh, just overnight?
It's one night. If you get it the next day, good. If not, they rot.
And I know we're going to talk about truffles in a little bit, and the moon is involved in that, but could you expand a little bit more about how the moon influences harvesting ingredients, or how that type of information is passed down over the generations?
Well, the way I grew up on a farm, my dad used to do everything according to the moon, everything. Even cut his own hair.
Really?
Everything was according to the moon.
What type of moon did it have to be for him to get a haircut?
It must turn.
It must turn.
Once the moon turns, you start doing things. The last days with a full moon, you don't do nothing.
Okay, so this is like not when it's a new moon, when it turns from the full moon and starts to...
It must turn. The moon must grow.
Oh, okay. Oh, so after new moon.
After full moon, yeah.
After full moon. Okay. I got it. So he cut his hair, and what else would you do by the schedule?
We used to do everything, like plant any kind of plants, or even cut any kind of plant. It must be according to the moon.
And if you went, I'm not saying that you would go against it, but if you were foolish enough to go against it, what type of travesty or what type of problems would you encounter?
It affects the nature immediately. You see, the next growth will be less, guaranteed. If you cut the grass at a full moon, once it turns, it won't grow that tall anymore.
Hmm. And does the influence of the moon still affect your cooking, or are you in the kitchen today?
I wouldn't say it affects me in the cooking, but I do know when to get the products at the right time.
Have you turned away people who showed up at the back kitchen door with produce, being like, the moon is not right, please come back at another time?
Back in Italy, yes.
Really?
Yeah. You simply don't accept certain products if they come at the wrong time of the month.
Right. And would the purveyors be understanding, or would they think that, you know, that's just the old way of doing things, or what was their response?
Sure. Back when I was there, they used to actually deliver and also respect those. Now it's no longer like that, but that's how I grew up.
Hmm. One of the other stops along your career was the Rainbow Room, which, I mean, I just have to say, I mean, if you have someone who's worked there, it must be talked about. Can you talk a little bit about your experience up there? I mean, it's such like a different atmosphere to cook in, especially in 99.
Rainbow Room is fun. I do think it's a fantastic place.
Yeah.
No, it's fantastic. Somebody that really can make it up there, in the long run, it's good. It's a tough place to be.
What are some of the hardships, or what are some of the challenges of cooking in Rainbow Room?
Well, it's the place consists in a la carte cooking, banquets. You go from breakfast all the way to supper. I mean, you name it, from the most expensive banquets. I mean, we did it all up there. And running a big kitchen like that, actually it was two kitchens. On top of that, we did the Top of the Rock. It was a big operation.
Was there a finest moment up there? Like a moment of, did you ever feel in control of that place, or did it feel like it was just an unwieldy master?
No, I sure did.
Yeah.
I was like day and night up there, 7 days a week, so I kind of really enjoyed it.
Where did you, was there a place you could sleep up there, or a place to hide?
No, it was not. But I must say I did enjoy it.
Okay. So what went into the opening of East 12th Osteria? Like, what was the process? And also the location is amazing too, but maybe not exactly where you would think you would find a high-end Italian place.
Sure. I mean, look, East Village is a fantastic part of the city. We really loved it. Me and my wife went there, checked out the area and so on, and then once we found that little corner, we went straight for it. So East Villagers are absolutely fine people. It's so nice to sit there at the window and see all these people passing by and so on. It's actually a theater going on right outside of our windows. It's fantastic. I really love it.
A little bit like out here. Maybe not as active.
Almost the same.
Almost the same. And I mean, you've traveled so extensively. You've done so much education. What type of philosophy went into putting together the menu for the restaurant?
I do believe it, no matter where you go to work in New York City, it doesn't matter which area, as long as you somehow respect the area you are, pricing, based on pricing and so on. I do think you can really be open and try to present whatever you feel like showcasing to them. So,
and is there, I mean, in the way that Puccini was the mushroom of your youth, is there a dish at the restaurant that you feel embodies the area, being true to it, the type of customers you have, that maybe was not even there originally but evolved over time?
The reaction was quite good. I mean, even in using truffles, that there aren't many using truffles in East Village, but the reaction was positive, so that's good. Even the menu, we don't have that many young people coming to us, but like more established people are definitely like enjoying the place, enjoying the food, great comments, and so on. I mean, I'm very happy with what we have done.
Speaking about truffles, obviously 'tis the season of truffles. Not every restaurant serves a truffle menu. So how did you arrive at that decision? Was it something that you've always served and you will be? Or it seems like, you know, it's a huge expense. There's a lot of money going out into it. How does one develop the desire to take on a truffle menu?
Well, look, truffles has been my whole life. I've always worked with truffles. Everywhere I worked, it's in my culture. I do think that if you give them the options, not actually having to buy a full dish, you can share it, split it, or whatever, or you create tasting menus that you work with them with their budgets, and they can also enjoy that product, then it works.
Do you have, can you recall any of your first truffle experiences?
That was way back, back when I was 13 years old, that I actually didn't completely understood the value of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, the back then that owner wasn't really that happy with me because I...
And where, sorry, where in the world are you at this time?
That was back in Alta Padilla.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of, you know, I couldn't actually at that time really... handle them.
No one's going to yell at you. It's so many years
ago. I just messed up a bunch of them, like in cutting them very thick. Once they are cut, you can't anymore recut them. And, you know, so I made huge thick slices and I wasted a whole bunch of them.
I mean, your nervousness right now, it must have been such a mistake. No one can hurt you now. You're in a safe place.
It wasn't a nice experience, that one. It, you know, with the, that was quite a damage. So.
And when do you feel, 13 was your first introduction, that you really felt that you understood and respected the ingredient and, you know, maybe some of the first dishes that you learned to use them in?
Well, then over time, then after being scolded properly, then you really understand the product and you'll be more careful. And obviously, like you see, even the people that come and eat that, you kind of automatically earn respect for it.
And what makes, for people who don't know, what makes a good truffle?
Well, the truffles are tough. You know, if it is too warm, it's a warm year, they are terrible truffles. You know, all you can hope is that it is kind of a somehow rainy but most dry year. So that means... And then a good cold fall that will definitely bring you to the bring the best truffles. Like this year, we have very good truffles, but not many.
Is that due to the warm weather?
It was too warm. It was too warm. It was too rainy in that area. It's not a good year in amount wise. It's not a good year.
Okay. Well, we're going to take a quick musical break, and then we're going to talk about the White Truffle Lady. How you can get on her good side, and then we're going to talk about the menu that you're currently serving. But up first, we have a track from our favorites, Au Revoir Simone, live on Snacky Tunes.
Pizza pies.
Is this a good tempo?
Is this how you guys roll every day?
This is how we roll every day.
Wow. It's amazing you guys aren't fat.
Thank you.
are slowly, slowly coming into view. The images are slowly,
finding out for once I know there's less to life, what's more is looking
the
for me.
The images are slowly,
seeing yes in style and no, not wondering what might come my
the
direction.
The images are slowly,
won't be long, best just to gaze and daze and fall to dream something familiar.
It's all, it's
all,
it's all,
or nothing.
It's all, it's all.
Oh, I love those girls so much. Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. So let's talk about Francesca, because A, you didn't include her last name in this, which duly noted. And two, I want to know how you get a truffle lady. How do you court someone to bring you the world's best truffles?
Francesca. She's the fresh air of New York City. Talking about truffles, yeah. I mean, she changed the market. She changed completely our way to love truffles again.
Let's take a step back. Where was it before her, and how does she change it, and where is it now?
When Francesca came approached me the first time.
What year actually, is this, by the way?
Excuse me.
What year did she arrive?
Like around 3 years ago, I think.
Okay.
3-4 years ago.
Okay.
So she approached me, and actually the first time I said no, what I say to everybody, you know, I don't want anybody to come to approach me to sell anything just like that.
Was the moon wrong?
I wasn't really the moon, but yeah, that's how I am.
Yeah.
And Francesca, I told her okay for one shipment, and since then I stuck with her. It's the way they serve you is phenomenal. Quality, fantastic. Prices, always competitive. And she's honest. I mean, there's plenty truffle girls, women out there, but there's only one truffle lady.
Mm.
There's only one.
I like. And what was it? Do you remember what she said to you when you turned her down the first time, or is that just your general disposition?
Nothing.
Yeah.
She just walked away nicely without a problem. I mean, she never pushes for anything. But once you work with her, you don't. You seriously don't give up anymore.
And without giving away too many secrets, how many restaurants does she supply?
Well, again, probably all the best and biggest in New York City. She's going strong. I must say that, and everybody has nothing but great things to say about her.
And is it just her? Is there a history behind her, a family, or?
She comes from a travel family. Her dad, her uncle has a beautiful company there in Umbria, and they're doing great. Again, I mean, it's a very down-to-earth, honest company. I mean, they don't mess around with you.
And now is she in a position where, before she was coming to chefs, is she now sought after? Does she still seek out chefs, or how does she? Because I mean, you said if it's a bad season, not everyone can get it. Who gets the truffle lady, and who gets the sideline?
Well, many times you actually even suggest her where to go. You want also your friends, your chef friends, or somebody that you used to work with that actually you work for or that worked for you. You like them to buy from her because, I mean, it's the truffle business is it's kind of tough out there the way it is. Now, and to find a supplier that is honest doesn't give you Chinese black truffles or sneaks in anything low quality. It's hard to find. I mean, a person that you can trust, really trust, you stick with that person.
When you receive a truffle shipment, do you go through them? Is it a trusted sous chef? Who checks it, because they are so valuable?
No, I go through that. She comes. I mean, she tells you already before she comes. She tells you exactly what she has, quality-wise, prices, everything you want to know. Shows up, and you really get what she is actually promising you. It's really actually very easy to deal with her. And I mean, really, my life became much easier since I met her. Absolutely.
That's incredible. So once you have the truffles and it is in your blood, you know, how do you begin to build a menu around it, given that supplies might fluctuate, you know, given that the weather might change? How do you build the right, or how do you start to build the right menu?
Look, the whole year you're waiting for the white truffles. Black truffles are common. I mean, you go from the summer truffles to the French Périgord and so on. I mean, the whole year you can find decent, good black truffles. But for the white truffles, you wait the whole year for those. And the whole year she keeps you kind of updated. Not the whole year, but through the summer she tells you already. She knows already what is coming up, quality. She tells you about the weather and then the whole thing. She foresees everything already, the way it's coming. So that's basically what you expect and go for. Then you build the menu. The menu is always, you can be not too creative. Obviously, you try every year to change your tasting menu, but you can't move away from certain risotti, pastas, and so on that you actually eat white truffle with. You just can't move away from that. You can improve in finding a better rice, a better quality ingredient, but you kind of stick with that, and then you obviously can work on your tasting menu and make it slightly more interesting, adding other ingredients and so on. Like this year, we are playing with chocolate and truffles, which is absolutely fantastic. Ricotta, chocolate, and truffle.
Oh my God! Sounds. Yeah. How far out from truffle season does she begin to sense what it's going to look like?
The whole summer, like let's say in July, she tells you already what is going to. I mean, she's already telling. Obviously, she's in touch all the time with her family, and they tell her already how the season is going to be, and exactly what she said is happening this year.
If someone has not had too much experience with white truffles, and they can't go all in for the tasting menu, it might be too rich for their pocketbook. Is there one particular dish that you feel really is the epitome or really showcases the ingredient above all else? Or you can pick two. I don't want you to pick a favorite. You can pick two.
You know, to play safe, to really play safe.
We'll do one safe and one not safe.
One not safe and one safe. Good. Okay. The not safe would be seafood and truffle. That is something you need to be really good with.
Why is that?
I mean, there is some seafood that you would... I mean, I do think that luxury goes with luxury. You know, if you pick seafood, then you go definitely with like langoustines, Dover sole, all the most prestigious kind of seafood. I would never go with branzini or any kind of whatever, calamari, whatever you name it, that has nothing to do with truffle. Sometimes people might try, especially new chefs, they want to be creative on their own and come up with these things. It simply doesn't work, period. Right. That is the difficulty in pairing truffle with. You go with luxury with luxury. If you play safe, then you definitely go with a nice thin carpaccio with truffle or like any kind of risotto pasta. Just keep it simple.
Okay. I'm sold. 100%. Well, I want to thank you for coming on to Snacky Tunes. Before you go, can you tell people where to find the restaurant, how to make reservations, how long the truffle menu will be running for?
We are located in the East Village, 12th Street and First Avenue, the corner, the northwest corner, beautiful location. The truffle menu will be on until probably the 20th of December, and then it depends if there's still something coming or not. We are not going to push it. Even late harvest might go bad, so we prefer to just cut it off. Right now we have beautiful truffles, really beautiful truffles that we are offering as a tasting menu for $200, which is absolutely a fantastic price for that kind of quality we are offering. And or they can choose simple single dishes for anywhere between $25, the chocolate crepe, all the way up to $180 Dover sole.
Perfect. Well, thank you for coming on. We have Wall coming up next, and then we have The Present live in studio here on Snacky Tunes.
Thank you.
Seen in a magazine, left on a pavement, taking it underground, needed to save it. Let's go on holiday, picture the type of place, me on the seaweed wave.
Welcome back. In the studio, we have The Present. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Thank you for having us.
Do you want to introduce yourselves?
Hey, I'm Rusty Santos.
And this is Mina Ohashi.
I really like the concept of your band of creating music that you feel right now, because it seems like pretty ephemeral. How does the day-to-day or even week-to-week influence the music that you make?
It influences a lot.
Anything visceral we take in.
Do you feel like you feel the world in a different way? And, you know, how does that affect the sounds? Or how do you define a sound that's ever continually changing?
I think a lot depends on the music we're listening to. Also what's going on in the world. But I think what we really, like if our music, the music we're kind of zoomed in on changes, then the sound of our music changes. And that was sort of the concept of our band. Like, when we started, it was completely different than what it is now because times have changed. It's a different world. So we just go with that feeling.
What was some of the earlier sounds, or give context for that?
Early on, we had Early on, we had a drummer, and we were kind of, like, making soundscapes, and it was still electronic, but it had a lot of live elements to it.
Like stream of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Was in the material preconceived, or was it just like get up on stage and just whatever came out of you?
More like record in the house, in the bedroom.
Okay.
Type, yeah.
Got it.
Well, our stage show was, we had a lot of parts. We would have improvised sections, but I mean, you know, stuff that we knew we were going to play, and then it would go stretched out into jams. But on our first two records, a lot of them started as improvisations. I think like the best stuff was started as improvisations. We kind of worked them out into full on orchestrations.
Yeah, kind of like capturing the moment.
And then how did it evolve over time, or what are some of the outworld influences that began to change the landscape?
Well, I think when we started, it was like heavy in the New York like kind of sound. Back then, we used to kind of mix acoustic and electric, and that was like a lot of the records I was a part of did that. And then we kind of made the decision we're either going to go with the acoustic or the electric, because it's kind of mixing them seemed to be like not doing either side justice. So we stuck with the electronic side of it. We're heavily influenced by dance music and into dance music. And then there was a period around 2009 when it seemed like the music coming out of Chicago was more exciting to us than the music coming out of New York, and we kind of pushed our attention over there. And it coincided when we met with Rashad and those guys and heard the first footwork that was coming out of there. And then working with them, they kind of showed us how they made tracks, and then that changed the way that we made tracks. So like maybe 10 years ago, even if we had the similar equipment, we approached it in a very different way than after we kind of learned how they're doing tracks.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, go on.
I'd say our New York friends, the past 10 years has been a really big influence on how we play our music and share our music. And so I would say New York and Chicago underground music has been a really big influence on the present.
What was one of the things they showed you in making music that kind of opened your eyes or changed the way that you made it?
I think it was the way that you can change the rhythm aspect, where it seemed like a lot of the people we were making music with, associated with at the time, when we first, on our first records, you'd have like a stable drum beat that's going, and then we kind of flipped that so that the drum beat is always changing, and then moving that around electronically, whereas melodies used to kind of fly all over the place, then the melody kind of became like a center point, and then the rhythm is always shifting and fluctuating. And same with like the bass and the kicks and those type of elements. It's just, instead of just having a loop, that's like where the creativity happens.
I would say I'd always had fun improvising and, you know, going free in music. But the biggest thing that I learned being in the studio with DJ Rashad was he would teach to play with the percussive elements inside the music, and that was definitely like an eye-opening experience for me, to not just the melody but play with the percussive elements too. So you're dancing and singing at the same time when you're singing.
Why don't we hear a song?
Okay.
What are you going to play first?
Oh my god.
Okay. Live on Snacky Tunes.
Oh my God.
Amazing. You recently played with Panda Bear. What was that like?
That was great. We love playing Bowery Ballroom. I think it was the third time we played there. And yeah, every time it's amazing because they have a real intimate feel. We could connect with people. People were dancing, which is kind of surprised, I think, even the people dancing. It was a good show.
That was like one of the first venues I ever went to when I moved here, and I didn't realize how good it was until I went to a lot of other venues, but yeah. They really built that one properly. Do you have any other places that you love playing, or like are areas that are receptive to the music you make?
We had a show earlier this year. It was at a bar, but it was a good bar. It was Elvis Guest House. That was a good show. Yeah, I mean, it seemed like a lot of the places we used to always like to play aren't around. So, you know, it changes really fast, but that one's still around, so that's good.
We played El Cortez.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like a week ago, two weeks ago.
Yeah, that was cool. That's a brand new place.
Yeah,
and then we might even play there again soon, actually. So mm-hmm. Those are good spots.
So we talked a little bit about where your music was and kind of how it evolved. What is your music like now in 2000? Well, I guess towards the end of 2015, 2016. Yeah.
Right now, well, yeah, we're kind of we're on a 160, kind of like a faster BPM than the halftime thing. Like you heard in that song, we can kind of go switch in between like the fast and the slow. I think that's like a big part of what we're interested in right now, are these like kind of flipping it upside down halftime and then double time.
I'm interested in mixing live piano, maybe bring back the acoustic elements. That might be really interesting.
And you said, you know, that's a different world earlier. Like, what outside influences of the world have affected the music that you make?
Well, we did a show earlier this year in Lisbon, and we were super into the Prince of a Disco. So, like, there's this whole group of people making music, and we kind of got, similar to how we got into Chicago, this, like, thing is, like, really amazing what these kids are doing.
What is it called again?
Well,
Prince of a Disco.
That's the label. Yeah. It's called Prince of a Disco, but it's this group of kids from like the outer suburbs of Lisbon, and they make a dance music that's kind of like slow down and warped sounding. It's really cool. A lot of I think the main group of people, they have this, they go by Familia Fox, and like all of them have different acronym in the word Fox in their name.
DJ Ninga Fox.
DJ Mar Fox. Yeah. So I think that kind of like open up our ears a bit to some of these like global sounds and what's going on there. And then, yeah, some of our friends there were showing us other stuff. So, and then also out of Atlanta, and I mean, I'm really into American music right now for the first time in a long time. I feel like some of the best music's coming out of America, particularly with Atlanta, with the Awful Records and the stuff that You know, like Future, Metro Boomin, that Young Thug, all that hip hop, like the best hip hop in America coming out of Atlanta and LA, Brooklyn, some really good scenes.
And what elements are you taking from there and bringing it into your music?
Well, I think that's like the halftime part. Where I was like, so like definitely when we're on that halftime zone, that's kind of like has that like American hip hop feel. And then when we double time, that has like this sort of like UK influence or, you know, Portuguese influence. It has like that like European dance side. But I mean, it's still very American what we're doing.
Cool. Can we hear another song?
Yeah. Sure.
What's the name of this one?
Coming To.
Okay. So you put out two EPs called Energy and Sound this year.
Yes.
What was the inspiration for those two EPs? Or how did they come into being?
It came from just improvising and catching the moment and just jamming on the machine, as for Rusty. and me on microphone and just capturing what comes out and not going back, not so much a back and forth, just going at it and capturing the moment, yeah.
Yeah, it was more aggressive than some of the stuff like we were expecting. We kind of just came out and we were rolling with it. Like so that's why we stuck with the energy, you know, like that was what we were feeling.
And is the improvisation happening at the same time, or is it you lay out the music and then you respond to it, or is it same rooms, same time, same energy?
As for this round, Rusty came up with the tracks first and then I went in and just sang on it. Yeah.
But yeah, and then even when, but it kind of feeds off each other, and I think the way that it gets arranged changes after that, and so, yeah, there's always like kind of like trying to find creative ways to improvise inside of a machine that, like a sampler, you know, that doesn't like expressively work like that. Like, but then you could find these like limitations inside of just like you would with any kind of instrument, but electronically, like, how do you do something completely in a moment when the machine's meant to program or to compose? So that's kind of like what we are exploring, is like keeping that live energy while you're recording or programming. And so that's how it came out.
And translating that from like the improvisation, do you just kind of play it as it lays, or do you go back in and maybe edit it or cut it together in some way to make cohesion, or is it just kind of what happens happens? And then
I think every song is different, and we don't have like a one method that we stick to. We let the track kind of speak for itself, because it comes from the track. It's inside it. Like sometimes it asks for more attention and time, and some tracks are just like it raw. So,
but yeah, and that's true. But then there are certain rules within it too, like with the like how we'll do like 16 bars or 32 bars, 8 bars, and there's kind of like we follow these like codes that we learned from working with a lot of the Chicago guys. That was one of the things they really taught us, is you have certain structures, and when you get those structures, you can go wild, like whatever you want. But then you know, like, we're not going to change on the 6th bar, it's going to change on the 8th bar.
Right. I mean, creativity always comes from some form of constraint, like when everything's an option, like nothing happens.
That is so true.
So that's such a great lesson. And how long did it kind of take for you guys to codify your own set of rules? Like, when did that come into play?
I really think, if you notice, we put out 3 records this year, and it's the last one was a long time before that. We were releasing stuff on SoundCloud and everything, but it took years. Like from where
shout out to Jamie, by the way.
Oh yeah,
thanks for connecting us.
Yeah. He put out.
Hi Jamie, thank you.
Yeah,
you were saying that it was you had put out a record a long time ago, and then like kind of as it you
I
put
mean,
out
yeah,
this
like
year
from the first ones we were talking about, the kind of like acoustic electronic explorations to where we're doing right now, that was 5 years.
Yeah. And I think it's about like understanding each other's roles. Like,
yeah,
you're in charge of this and I'm in charge of this. Like, understanding the dynamics was definitely an organic experience. It's not like, oh, you're the producer and you make it from here to here and I'm the singer slicing from here. It's never like that. It was just
I mean, we're both the producer, kind of weird.
Yeah,
business.
So understanding that without even like planning out talking about it, just like doing it, and kind of like Jim.
But I mean, after being playing together for a number of years, I mean, are the roles set, or is it even within like the improvisation that you might change roles or take on new roles or different direction?
It's fluxious, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, they're becoming more set. We would definitely, we're open for anything, but then I feel like kind of like part of what the present has become is I'm like deeply inside the electronics and the mix, and she's deeply in the vocals and the mix as well, kind of.
So, and the songwriting.
Yeah, I mean, one thing earlier when we were talking about the improvisation, we don't really, like, mixing is kind of part of that process, too. It's not like we finish it, and then now it's time to mix. It's like we finish it, and it's finished from the way. So from the start of the composition to recording to mixing to mastering, that all kind of happens in the same process, and then it's done. Mm-hmm.
It's a really interesting way to evolve making music. So like the output must be higher, or is it still you feel the same, or there's a lot of stuff that happens that like you learn on that one that's down and then you start again? because you're refining the process during the recording.
Yeah, I mean, we'll, for each of the, like, the energy and sound series, which we're not really, hasn't wrapped up yet, we still have more and more coming, because that's kind of just like, we finish, and then we finish a number of tracks, and then we're like, okay, these ones are going to get released, and then we move on to the next one. So yeah, we get a lot of extra tracks that we got to find stuff to do with, yeah.
Is there, and I know it's ever-evolving, but is there a current checklist or barometer for an energy and soundtrack that's like, okay, this hit like a certain, these 5 or 6 points, and it will get released as opposed to another track?
I think, yeah, because we're going to do other things besides energy of sound and sound, but when it, for the moment, if the songs we've been playing here, like, it has to like sell, like, we have to feel it to that extent, get same level of excitement, and then it gets on, it passes that, yeah.
Yeah, as for me, I think the one that the vocals comes naturally and the lyrics comes naturally is the one that I'm definitely going to capture and go deep.
Yeah, if you're working too hard on it, then that means something.
I want to make sure we have time for one more song, but question to each of you.
Yeah.
What right now is currently influencing you the most on the way in which you create music?
Right now?
Like right now.
I'd say the voices I've been, yeah, listening the whole time of the customers.
Oh, okay. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that, how is that playing into it?
Oh, it's like, it's music.
Okay.
I like how you went right now, as in this second in this back room, because I was thinking like, okay, over the past couple weeks, what has been influencing?
I mean, but I think, yeah, both responses, yeah, are equally, I mean, how or which you might define the present is equally unique. So so you went right now, but right, you now went to the last few weeks, so we can take a very legitimate answer from the past few weeks.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's been a lot about what I hear, like in cars in our neighborhood. Like, we live uptown, and when I hear sounds coming through the cars, like, what are the sounds that I'm hearing? Is it the synthesizer? Is it the bass line? Or is it the hi-hat? And, like, of course, like, it's usually from a future track, or, you know, like, What a Time to Be Alive or something like that. And I'm like, oh, how's that going to work in? And what happens if we double time underneath that? And so definitely, like, the kind of ambient sounds of the city have been at work, and then you combine that with sirens and train tracks and all this extra noise too, and then something, whatever cuts through, and like, that's kind of like delivering a message.
That's great. How can people find you, get your EPs, follow you?
The best way to find us is SoundCloud/thepresent. Find us on SoundCloud, and that'll connect you to the Bandcamp and the Twitter, and yeah.
Awesome. Well, again, thanks, Jamie, for putting us together.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. And what's the name of the last song you're going to play for us?
No, the other one.
Okay. We're going to do Illusion.
Okay, great. Well, thanks for listening. And we will be back next week with another episode of Snacky Tunes.
Illusion, 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 illusion.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.